But don't play with me, 'cause you're playing with fire. But don't play with me, 'cause you're playing with fire.
Good morning and welcome to Playing with Fire, Long Island's only food, wine, and lifestyle show. I'm your host, Tom Shortell. As usual, I'm here with co-host and producer Stu Schrager. Good morning, Stu.
Good morning, Tom. Good to see you.
Good to see you, too. What's happening?
Not too much. You know, it's a pretty quiet week, but I did come with one thing that sticks in my mind. When I do grocery shopping, I usually go anywhere that doesn't really matter. Stu Leonard's, King Cullen, Stop and Shop.
No real allegiance.
No real allegiance, more convenience.
Yeah, yeah.
But, and 9 out of 10 times, those are the shops, the stores that I go to. I was with my mom the other day and went to Trader Joe's, which I go occasionally.
Yeah.
And I'm really amazed and curious what your thoughts are on Trader Joe's. A niche supermarket with a lot of different products.
Yeah.
All, I guess, private branded in a sense. But have you shopped there?
I don't shop.
You don't shop?
I don't. It's the oddest thing. I mean, you know, I keep very little food in my house because I'm never there, and B, you know, I don't really eat a lot when I go home. I was just saying this to a doctor friend of mine the other day that, you know, the only thing I really snack on is cheese, which isn't probably the best thing in the world for your cardiovascular system, but sure tastes good, you know. So my shopping really is, you know, every once in a while I wind up at Restaurant Depot for something I forgot to order.
Gotcha.
And I'll pick up a thing of Snapple, or I'll pick up, you know.
Well, the thing that got my curiosity.
I mean, I've been in Trader Joe's, but,
well,
you know.
I mean, the ambiance of it is it seems like it's healthy eating.
Yeah, well, yeah, I think that people have that perception that, you know, if you go to Trader Joe's, you're doing yourself a favor with organic this. And
and there's all sorts of unique things. They had, this was a crazy one, corn curls. So it's like they scrape the corn off the cob.
Right.
And they were sort of like curly French fries, it looked like.
Really?
Something that would really relate to you is they had tricolor carrot slices in some sort of seasoned broth or whatever, which was a Thanksgiving side dish that
you created for
us.
For sure.
Multicolor broccoli spearettes.
Uh-huh.
Spears. But it, again, it was a lot of Indian products. Just intriguing. And I wonder. Before Trader Joe's, where did people get that stuff?
I don't know. I don't know if it was all that available. I mean, you know, I've seen the food scene grow from, you know, steak cookie, steak pub, and that kind of thing into what it is now. You know, my grandmother, I remember she was the best cook I knew growing up. And, you know, she had the most exotic vegetable she had was turnips, you know what I mean? It was just... Now, I mean, you know, between air travel and refrigeration techniques and DNA of these vegetables, I mean, there's almost nothing that's not available here in the U.S., you know, until COVID, and then nothing was available.
But I guess my thought process goes to, is the perception real? Because I'm a skeptic.
Mm-hmm.
I go into the traditional supermarket, and there's lean cuisine,
right.
And I think I'm doing the right thing. And it might be portion control correct, but I'm told that, like, the salt content is just not
should be. Of course.
So I find, you know, I don't think there's truth in the advertising. Just like, you know, all those infomercials where you take a pill and you're going to be perfect in life. I can't believe that the government lets these people, you know, promote these things. And, again, if it's real, then I'm wrong. But I have to believe it's all a bunch of smoke and mirrors.
Well, I think you've had a death of truth in America on a wholesale level. I mean, it's just, you know, nobody tells the truth anyway. I can't even tell you what a woman is. I mean, it's like bizarre, right? I mean, up is down, down is up, left is right, right is left. It's crazy. And I think it's the same with food. I mean, I think that, you know, things that are branded to be, you know, good for you and dietetic, this, that, and the other thing, you know, while they don't have the same disclaimers that you know, the drugs have on TV, and I don't watch much TV, but 50% of what I see is drug sales on TV. I mean, you know, you know, Ozempic and this, that, and the other thing, and it's, and then they give you the list of, you know, you have some mild, you know, side effects like a finger growing out of your forehead, and you know, all the other stuff that they give you. This list of, you know, 25 or 30 side effects, but you know, we're a drug-addled country. I mean, it's just nuts, you know, and they put a lot of stuff in the food. There's chemicals in there. I mean, the best thing you can do, I think, if you want to, you know, hold their feet to the fire is to read the label, you know, because they're by law, they have to tell you what's in it. So it's in there on every label. It's just not on the front cover. You know what I mean? You know, you got to kind of search for the small print. But I think that, you know, a Trader Joe's, while I've been in Trader Joe's, I don't really shop there. I don't know it. Maybe I've been in two of them, you know, in my whole life. I think their thing is we're a more enlightened, more, you know, kind of hipper, you know, vegetarians go there.
And
you know,
reasonably priced.
Are they? Yeah. I wouldn't know.
But, I mean, again, I'm not being negative on the store. Actually, I was quite entertained by it. Again, mm-hmm. the different varieties of things that were, you know, things that you wouldn't normally, I mean, anything from, again, the Indian dishes, shumai, and on and on and on.
Well, a lot of those things are vegetarian, too. I mean, Indian cuisine is kind of vegetable-driven to some degree. You know, you don't see a lot of beef, and I mean, they are beef in your chicken, tikka masala, and all
of
that.
Some of the trends they get involved with, I'll never forget when, it's only about 6 years that rice cauliflower became a thing.
Yeah.
And they were rationing it. I mean, like, you had to know somebody.
You can only buy one grill.
And then just,
yeah, like, just take it home and put it on a grater. I mean, what's the big deal?
I've done that. Yeah, you can do it yourself.
Sure.
And then there was hearts of palm pasta was a big thing. Now it's plenty of product. But at the time, I mean, you know, as soon as it was on the shelf, it was gone.
Yeah, well, I think there's people that have, you know, issues, you know, with food. Some real, some imagined. But issues nonetheless. And then, you know, something like a gluten-free pasta or you know, a palm. Gluten-free pasta they make out of corn. You know, I've never had palm, hearts of palm pasta.
Essentially, it's shredded hearts of palm, you know, shredded laterally. Mm-hmm. So it looks like spaghetti. You can get away with it, you know, as far as eating it.
It's like zucchini pasta.
Right, but, you know, I'm a traditionalist, and I don't know if it's psychological, but if I mix a little traditional pasta in with it, I have a much more tasty entree.
You know, it's funny. I'm you know, I'm getting long in the tooth, right? I'm getting up there in years, so I've gained a lot of experience and food experience because I've been in this game since 1968 is when I started. So it's a long time now. And you know, I watched when I was a kid. Maybe we had one kid with a peanut allergy in the entire school. Now everybody has one. You know, nobody worried about gluten. We've been eating, you know, what bread is to man over the years. I mean, it's fed the entire world. Now there's gluten. And I said to a friend of mine the other day, if Iran ever figures out how to get gluten in a missile, we're done. You know, all I have to do is explode one gluten missile in New York and, you know, everybody be running for the hills. Yeah. It's like, it's hilarious.
But again, portion control is crazy. Like now they have all these specialty cookie companies. Retailers, and you know, in the old days it was David's or whatever, mm-hmm. and Otis, or Spunk Micah or something.
Oh, careful now.
But you know, it was a normal size cookie. Today, you get something that's the size of a hockey puck, and it's like 1,000 calories.
Yeah.
And most people don't know how to navigate through portion control. So if they're getting a cookie, they're going to eat the cookie. Which drives me to the mentality of the different restaurants where they list calories. And, you know, you look at an entree at some of these restaurants and 1,000 calories.
Yeah.
And you go, whoa. I guess I'm talking about Cheesecake Factory and Grand Lux Cafe.
Yeah, yeah.
I guess they can't be listing the calories because they want to. However, most restaurants don't list the calories.
No, there's a law now with some. I think Cheesecake Factory said that's voluntary, but there's a law that some of them have to be.
Again, when you go for the pasta alla rosa, which is a fictitious entree,
I was going to say, did you make that up?
75 calories.
I know it's.
And that's before you have your appetizer or your cocktail or your 750-calorie piece of cheesecake at the end.
You know, this is all lawyers gone crazy. I mean, you know, anybody with a eighth grade education knows that, you know, eating too much of, let's say, pasta or something is going to have a higher calorie count. I mean, you can feel it, you know. I mean, you know yourself when you eat too much pasta, you feel like you got to go to the couch and go to sleep. That's your body telling you, you know, listen, I got some work to do here, dude. You know, you kind of screwed up the system a little bit. So I think that, you know, if you, you know, moderation, I think self-control is one of the hardest things to kind of, the hardest discipline to kind of get under your belt, because temptation is everywhere, you know, and most of us are slaves to temptation, me being, you know, king of that. But I think that in the end, you know, like you say, portion control is the key to maintaining, I think, weight and just a, you know, a moderate life where, you know, it's funny with the body, you know, people, and I'm going to use hangover as an example, right? You have this baseline health thing, right? And when you get high, they tell you it's hot, you're getting high, right, on alcohol, so you go above the baseline. In order to get back to balance, you have to go below it to get back, you know, so that's where the hangover comes in again. And it's the same with food. I think if you eat too much food, then you got to kind of, you know, balance that out by, you know, behaving yourself for a day or two. You know, so that's why people have those reward days, you know, when on a diet, I'm not eating sugar, but Sunday, watch me on Sunday, I'm going to have that Hershey bar or whatever. So I think that, you know, from the food perspective, and I deal with a lot of different, you know, phobias and neuroses and things like that as far as food goes, and real issues, obviously. Most people who just moderate, you know, if you have a gluten issue, like if you have celiacs, you know, you can't have gluten. I get it. You know, there's dire consequences. But, you know, the people say, well, I'm gluten sensitive. That's probably just all bull. That's just a diet choice, which is fine if that's what you want to do. But you could probably eat, you know, a piece of whole wheat bread every once in a while and not, you know, wind up in a hospital, you know. And I think that as long as you moderate things, you know, you maintain your weight. And, you know, what do they call that? That one blood sugar, I can't remember, but it's produced when you eat more than you need. And the body kind of stores that to the side. I forget what the letters are, but it's the bad cholesterol or whatever. And it puts it off to the side, and that's due to overeating, most of it, you know. So if you just eat what you need, you're in pretty good shape. I mean, and you know, nature has provided all these wonderful colored things to kind of, most people don't realize that colors of the vegetables mean something, you know. Like people don't say eat your greens. They don't say eat your blues, you know what I mean? Eat your greens, because, and they're all green. Why? Is that a shock? It's set up that way, so you're supposed to, you know, eat them. And, you know, I think that, you know, if you think about it, you know, most people don't really think about what they eat. They just eat what they eat, hence McDonald's, you know, over 5 billion served or whatever. You know, if you really thought about it, you'd become what we used to call a health nut, but you would modify some of that stuff if you knew what it was going in. And I'm not a vegetarian or a vegan or anything like that. I mean, I eat beef and pork and chicken and fish and all that stuff. But for the most part, I think that if you stay with, you know, vegetables, you know, the Mediterranean diet, I mean, they eat a lot of fish, eat a lot of olive oil, eat a lot of vegetables. It's really not a big secret. And they say that's the one that produces the best result, you know.
Well, again, going back to Trader Joe's, I, the other night, I did my shopping, got home at night, in 2 minutes I had a portion of pad thai. It was actually pretty good.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, you move on to the next thing. But, they're really creative. They have frozen French onion soup.
Well, I think a lot of these places are employing real chefs now, you know. I look at the guy on TV on Channel 12. He always comes on with Uncle Giuseppe's. You know, they used to do cooking classes. I did a cooking class there. I did a demo with the girl from Channel 12, whose name escapes me at the moment, but Lily. Lily Stromberg. Salzburg?
Salzburg.
Yeah, nice lady. Salzburg. I mean, oh, we had a lot of fun with her. But anyway, now they just have that one chef. I think his name is Vinny or whatever.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he does these demos all the time. He's a real dude. He's a real chef. It's
yeah,
not
they
like,
did.
You know,
I saw a really cool thing. I guess it was around New Year's Eve or Christmas, medallions of a filet. And then he, you know, he presented it nice on a tray with in the middle some horseradish cream, whatever.
Yeah, no, it's great. It's great that somebody's on there doing that. I mean, you know, and kudos to Channel 12. I mean, they're, you know, as much as I'm mad at them for, you know, letting Doug Gied retire, you know, he's my friend and I thought he was great. But, you know, the bottom line is they do a good service in a lot of ways. I mean, they have some interesting, you know, kind of things there. But the food thing, you know, with Uncle Giuseppe's, I think is fabulous. And, you know, you look at places like that, you know, ShopRite, they never had real chefs. Now they have people who know what they're doing and they can.
The only problem with an Uncle Giuseppe's, and it's really not a critique. So if you want to be a sponsor of the show, you know,
feel free.
Yeah, please. but I find like Uncle Giuseppe's there. I'll call it the deli counter, but it's not. It's the prepared food counter.
Yeah.
I guess if you get it fresh, meaning I've been to Ivoroni Brothers or Uncle Giuseppe's on a Saturday morning. Oh, my God. The food is to die for. It's all fresh.
Yeah.
I mean, literally, you can go home and you can eat it and it's warm. You know, maybe you have to heat it a little bit.
Sure.
But eating it in that way, it's just unbelievable. And the variety of stuff. They'll have beef stroganoff. They'll have all sorts of different things.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just it really, really, really is incredible. But Kitchen Cabaret is another one like that. So, again, if you grab something on the way home and it's still fresh isn't the word, but
yeah, it's still new.
It's incredible. The next day, I'm not sure if because the average consumer doesn't know how to properly reheat it.
Yeah.
It's just not the same.
Well, that's why they call them leftovers, you know? I mean, you know, it's the same in your house. The only, I mean, I'll make a strong case for soups and stews that get better when they sit a day or two because I think the flavors tend to meld and settle in, you know, kind of like moved into a new house.
In today's lazy world, everybody puts stuff in the microwave, and cooking in the microwave is a bit different no matter what. Again, I'm not the expert. You're the expert.
Oh, it cooks from the inside out, which is
but
weird.
But it's different.
Yeah.
It's different.
It's convenient.
If you cook it on the stove and, you know, in a pot or whatever.
Yeah. Well, you know, Kung Fu, I studied Kung Fu for a bunch of years, right? Kung Fu means time and effort.
I'm confused.
You confused. Yeah, you have Tung Fu. But anyway... It means time and effort, and that's really the key to almost any successful endeavor. You know, whether it's learning how to play the piano, or learn how to cook, learn how to be a DJ, you know, you got to put in time and effort, you know.
So that's funny you say that because, like, you know, growing up, I was spoiled. I got to tell you, my mom was a phenomenal cook.
Yeah.
I can't really remember any meal that she made that wasn't incredible. And every night, my dad would get home, I guess, around 7 o'clock. He worked in the city. He took the train home. Either he walked back to the house, or my mom, I guess, picked him up. And when he came home, the four of us, my sister, my mom, and my dad, we'd sit down, and we'd have a meal that I believe, if I recollect correctly, you know, you'd have a salad.
Sure.
And you'd have your main serving, which was a vegetable and whatever it
was.
Yeah,
yeah.
But... you talk about taking things for granted. Then I got married. And oh my God.
What happened?
Did we go astray?
Yeah. Well, the whole generational thing. I mean, my mother cooked for six ungrateful children and her husband all those years. And she was, you know, my mother's from English background, and now they have some decent restaurants in London, but 40-50 years ago, the great joke was English food. I mean,
yeah,
it was just awful. And she wasn't a very good cook. She got better because A, she had to, and B, she got a lot of practice. But in the beginning, it was it was rough. My mother was a rough cook.
Yeah, talking about rough, I was with my mother last week, and she says, like, I'm getting tired. I don't know if I can do all this cooking anymore.
You better pick up the mantle, dude, But I think that the following generations never really, my grandmother's generation and my mother's generation were connected at the apron skirt, They kind of learned, my mother was a bad example because my grandmother on my mother's side was, English also, obviously, and she wasn't very good. But most of it came from grandma's passing it down to moms, and mm-hmm. But now our generation, my mother really never had my sisters in the kitchen. I never really remember them helping her other than washing the dishes or, bringing stuff from the stove to the table. So they didn't learn, And if you're not in the restaurant business or directly connected to the food business, whether it's in a restaurant or a hospital or, a Trader Joe's or something like that, what do people eat? They eat what they know, and they eat what their mom ate or whatever.
So that, now you got me thinking.
Fish sticks.
That's a product of the past. Do people really eat that these days?
My brother had the same menu. My brother wasn't in the food business, obviously. But he had the same menu that my mother had. He would have fish sticks on Friday and hot dogs and beans on Thursday, whatever.
Was fish sticks with macaroni and cheese.
Like. Yeah, macaroni and cheese. That was another one.
But I'm looking back now. So I'm not sure. My grandmother was a very independent woman. She had a couple of husbands along the way. She was working. And I don't know if she was an influence on my mother as far as cooking. But in the one of the later chapters of my grandmother's life, she met somebody. They got married, and they moved to Bethesda, Maryland. So we used to go down and visit. And my goodness, I guess that was like sort of the crux of my childhood. Anywhere from being 7 years old to going away to college. So when we would do the trips, and I've mentioned this before, we usually would go by car. And going down there, my mom would make all these different sandwiches. And they were sort of different than what we ended up coming back with. It was like, and I don't really remember what my mom made, but I know that when we went to my grandmother's, she, again, same scenario. My grandfather was a judge in D.C. He'd take the bus to work. He'd come home. My grandmother would make him a martini.
Nice.
And then there'd be like a rib roast, a leg of lamb, at least when we were there.
Yeah, yeah.
But something tells me it was always
oh, like yeah, that. Yeah, for sure.
And so, oh, my goodness, going home on the way, it was like, lamb on rye, did you want, and everything was already prepackaged.
Sure.
There was ketchup ones, there was mayo ones, there'd be meatloaf ones. Again, it was like unbelievable.
Good stuff, yeah.
Yeah, but I wonder what the connection, if any, was between my mom's ability to cook and my grandmother's. That's definitely a discussion for this weekend.
Yeah, cooking to me is, I love it so much. I think everybody should do it, I realize that's not going to be the case. But if you're going to do it, you have to like it. If you enjoy doing it, you get good at it. If you don't enjoy doing it, you get through it. You know what I mean? There's a big difference between, somebody who has a passion for something and somebody who's just going through the motions, So I think that, like any other endeavor, if you plan to get good at it, you're wasting your time if you don't like to do it.
But it's crazy. Again, you've got me in this retrospective mindset. I go to Brooklyn to visit my uncle, and my cousins lived around there, and one of the cousins, I guess, the matriarch, the in Jewish, I think they say Bubba.
Uh-huh.
The Bubba lived there.
Yeah.
And I always remember she'd be there in a house smock.
Yeah.
In front of, I mean, the woman was probably 87 years. She's probably 16, but looked 87.
Yeah, the apron with the pockets in the front.
Yeah. And it was the it was like sleeveless. It was just a scene. But she'd be standing in front of the stove, you know, with the big pot. My mind goes to making chicken soup or something.
Yeah, sure.
You know, and she'd be putting a dash of this, a handful of that, you know. And my mother was always frustrated because she would say, like, could I get, you know, this is really good. Can I get your recipe? And she would literally say, a pinch of salt, then you put a little garlic, then you do this. And
well, when I teach cooking, I tend not to use recipes only because you get stuck. You know, with a recipe, you get stuck. And recipes change. I mean, food tastes different at 3,600 feet than it does at sea level for whatever reason. It evaporates quicker, you know. So anyway, my point is that when you cook, you have to taste. And I tell this to young cooks all the time. You know, I'll taste the dish six or seven times before it goes out to the dining room. You know, most of my cooks, they do it and they put it out in the beginning, right? And I'm like, how do you know that tastes good? Well, how do you know? You don't know. You know what I mean? Unless you taste it, then you know, is it too much salt? Is there not enough? Did I put enough lemon in it? Is it, there's a million reasons it can go off the rails. And it's the same thing at home. I'd rather teach people techniques, you know, techniques like reduction of a soup, you know, why you boil it for an hour and a half instead of 20 minutes, because you're concentrating the flavors, you're evaporating water and the flavors stay in, you know. Why do we saute the vegetables before we make a stew or a stock? Why do we brown the meat first? You know, it's to keep the juices in. It's not for the color or anything like that. There's reasons that these things happen. And those are the things that I think that are important if you want to learn how to cook, is to get the techniques down, because the amounts change. My idea of something that's too salty might be different than yours. So if I give you a recipe and you may go, I don't know, there's a lot of salt in that, you know, and what do I do? You know, if you know how to cook, you taste it before and you add the salt as needed. You give a little more, or you stop when you got it to the point where you're comfortable with it. Because everybody's different. Everybody's, you know, I've had people send back stuff, it's too salty, and I'm tasting. I'm like, I don't think so, you know. So it's
no, and we had that conversation recently. I was over at Parkside and I got the pasta over linguine, and it's so sort of like a bouillabaisse.
Pasta over linguine?
seafood.
There you go.
Seafood.
I was going to say, linguine. No wonder your cholesterol is up.
It was like a bouillabaisse, but I found the broth to be like just. I'm not going to say it was fishy because it wasn't fishy.
Salt watery.
It just had a little too much salt for my taste. But it's funny. I was watching one of these TV shows the other day. I guess a lot on the weekends. A lot of the news programs do a chef segment, and I got a kick out of. They were making like a pasta arrabbiata.
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 Whatever you say. but I got a kick.
Let's
out
call
of the
whole thing off.
Like, you know, they were ready to strain the pasta.
Yeah.
And she goes, whoa, I need to get a cup of the pasta.
Plus the water.
Pasta water.
Yeah,
you know?
Sure. That thickens the sauce a little bit, you know. Plus, you know, if you're really cooking pasta correctly, you know, the water should taste like salt water. You know, most people don't put enough salt in their pasta water to get it flavored in the pasta, because pasta does have some flavor, but you need salt to bring it out. And then that water has starch in it, so that's used to thicken a butter sauce, or if you're going to make, let's say, cacio pepe, right? You're going to use a lot of shaved pecorino and a lot of black pepper. You know, that's not going to have any moisture to it. You know, it's just going to fall in. So if you use a little of that pasta water, that creates the sauce there.
So I got to hear, we have also talked about this a lot. I, to me, it's amazing. It's marketing in its simplest formula, but all the different shapes of pasta is absolutely crazy.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to figure, and hopefully I have the right name, but bucatelli.
Bucatini.
Bucatini, which is essentially spaghetti.
Spaghetti with a hole in it.
Why?
I don't know. I have no idea. I guess the hole fills with sauce or something. It's a pain in the ass to get it around a fork because it's too thick to twirl. So you get this pop, 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 you know, when you try to eat it, it's always in your chin. I don't know. I think bucatini's, I don't use it. I think it's just a major, you know, pain in the neck, you know, tell you the truth. But some of the other sauces are great, like penne. I always use penne rigate. And rigate means it has the lines in it, you know. And the sauce fills in those lines. You know, it grips the sauce better than just the smooth penne, which I guess people use for baked ziti.
What's the difference between penne and ziti?
It's kind of the same. Ziti doesn't have, you know,
the lines.
Yeah. But penne doesn't either, unless it's rigatte. That's the difference, you know. But penne and ziti
are
the same thing,
essentially. I'm not sure if it's penne or ziti, but the oversized that when you prepare it, it sort of collapses.
The rigatoni?
What's the difference between rigatoni, ziti, and...
It's just the shape, that's all, you know, and the different shapes. It came about. They have... The one I like is strazzo prete. It's priest stranglers, literally... you know, the
those are the curly, the small curly pieces?
No, they're kind of, they're, I don't know, 5-6 inches long and twisted, you know. But, you know, the Italians are funny. They're always, you know, clandestinely making fun of the Pope and the religion. So they'll call them priest stranglers. You know, the chicken tail, the rear end is called the Pope's nose, you know. It's really kind of funny, you know. They're rebelling in their own way, you know. But yeah, I think the different shapes are interesting, and I use different sauces. Like when I do a cacio e pepe, I always use spaghetti or linguine or fettuccine, long thin noodle, right? When I make a bolognese, I tend not to use the long thin noodle. I tend to use something shorter and fatter, because I think it's easier to get on the spoon. You know, you want to get the pieces of beef and the vegetables all with the pasta, so I think it's easier when you're twirling. You know, it's hard to twirl a couple of pieces of beef in that mess, you know what I mean? It just kind of falls to the side. So I think there's some thought behind, you know, a lot of us. I'll tell you a funny story. I used to tend bar. My friend had an old man's bar on Jericho Turnpike in Jericho a few years ago. It was called the Parkway Inn. And I used to tend bar there on Sundays as a goof on my day off because, you know, I'd watch the game. I'd be going down there anyway to hang with the boys, and I wind up making $100 instead of spending $100, you know. So they were having a discussion, two of the older guys. One guy says, "I got to go home. My wife is making twistetties for dinner." And the other guy goes, "Twistetties? What are you talking about?" He goes, "You know, that pasta, it's like, it's twisted. Twistetties. It's not called twistetties. They're called squiggolinis." You know? Two of them get a bet going. Like, it's a, you know, at the time, it was a $20 bet, which was a fairly large amount of money for a bar bet. You know, I know it was 1972 or whatever. And I had to drive the two of them to the Stop and Shop. And there we are in the pasta aisle. And the guy's asking, "You got any twistetties?" I'm sitting there with my fingers in my eyes. It's for silly, both of you. You know, you're both wrong. Twistetties, squiggolinis. Yeah, okay, whatever. But too funny.
That brings me back to, again, my youth. And I think Mom made wagon wheels all the time.
Well, that's good for the kids. You know, I remember they used to have a commercial on wagon wheels. I mean, Ronzoni or whoever it was. I guess it was Ronzoni. He was a big pasta maker when I was a kid. But wagon wheel spaghetti, I can almost remember the jingle. And alphabets. Remember alphabets? They used to put them in the soup. You could spell your name on the side of the bowl.
That's right.
I could never find a Y. You know, I'd stick with Tom.
Meanwhile, noodles are a big thing today. Obviously, ramen has become a...
Well, every culture has them, you know. I mean, you know, everybody thinks, you know, pasta is Italian, but it was brought to Italy by the Chinese. You know, the Chinese were the ones that introduced pasta.
And who decided in some ramen to throw an egg in there?
You know, some Japanese guy with a protein deficiency, probably. I don't know. You ask questions that are just universal.
I'm but like a food philosopher.
You are. Both of them spell with an F, though. You know, if you go to WHLI, fire at WHLI.
Yeah,
you
actually,
ask,
that's a good segue. We're having some technical difficulties, so... This week would be very interesting if our audience would try to help us and send us some messages at fire@whli.com, fire@whli.com. Maybe we'll even be able to retrieve them and respond.
Yeah, if you can, you know, figure out some food philosophical questions to stump Stu and I, it'd be great. But yeah, it's you know... I think that, where was I? I just lost my train of thought. Why don't we take a break while I'm having a stroke here? We'll come back and we'll talk about food.
Amano Osteria and Wine Bar has been created by Adam Lovett and Tom Shawdell to bring the feel and flavors of a true Tuscan Osteria to the North Fork. Amano showcases local growers, farmers, cheese, and winemakers, marrying their ingredients with the taste traditions of the Tuscan countryside. The casual appeal, the flavors of Italy, and a moderate price structure appeal to all, ensuring year-round patronage. This North Fork eatery sends out snappy salads and seafood, pastas and antipasta, along with a respectable wine list. Amano features local vineyards and Italian varietals from the U.S. and Italian wines. The kitchen remains open until 11 and has established a later dining crowd, sparking a local nightlife dining scene. Amano is on the cutting edge of a new high-quality and affordable dining experience on the North Fork. Amano Osteria and Wine Bar, 13550 Main Road in Matatuck. Serving dinner daily, Amano is also open for lunch on Saturday and Sunday. For reservations and further information, call them at 631-298-4800 or visit them on the web at amanorestaurant.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Playing with Fire on 1100 WHLI AM and 104.7 WHLI FM. Long Island's own food, wine, and lifestyle show with your host, Tom Shawdell, chef, author, and restaurateur.
The stroke victim. I think I've recovered. Anyway, yeah, so I want, you know what I want to talk about for a second? I've had the pleasure, absolute pleasure, of drinking some old wines lately. And I've noticed that there's a better than average chance that you're going to have a little cork issue. Because sometimes they lay down for a long time, right? The ones I have been in the cellar for a while, so they lay down. And the corks get kind of soft, and you can pull right through them. And it doesn't necessarily automatically mean the wine is shot. And so they have this new wine opener. I don't know if you've seen it or not, Stu. It's called a Durant, D-U-R-A-N-T. And they're fairly pricey. I just bought one off the internet. I think it was, I don't know, $150 or whatever. But it's basically an Osso, and if you don't know what an Osso is it's like a cork remover without a corkscrew. It's got these two thin little blades.
Oh, those are great.
Yeah, they go around the cork between the cork and the bottle, and you twist it, and it loosens the cork up, and you can pull the cork out. It takes a little practice. You know, your first Osso experience is usually a mess, but after a while, it's a good way to remove it. But the Durant has the Osso blades that go in plus a corkscrew. So you have twice the chance of getting this thing out that you have in a regular. And it's great for older wines. And I bought it, and it works fabulously. If you're out there and you have trouble with corks, or you just want to make sure that you know you don't, I highly recommend this corkscrew called Durant. It's you can get them on the internet there. It's a fabulous tool.
I Googled Durant, and I got Kevin Durant.
Oh, no, no. Maybe it's not Durant. Maybe it's Duran. Do some Dumont. Do put corkscrew. Put in wine remover.
Okay, I'm going to do Durant cork remover.
There you go. That'll do it. But it's a fabulous tool. And, you know, I highly recommend.
Durant. D-U-R-A-N-D.
All right, Durant. Yeah, okay.
And it's just like you said. Wow.
Yeah, no, it's fabulous. Fabulous tool. If anybody has the, you know, the distinct possibility of having older wine, I recommend highly that you get one of these because, you know, you don't want to be straining cork out of your wine. It's a pain in the neck and unnecessary if you have the right tools. And another thing about older wines, I'll tell you a quick story. I went to Rothmans the other night, and I highly recommend Rothmans if you're a wine drinker. First of all, if you're a steakhouse guy, Rothmans is as good as anything out there. They do a great job. But Sean Gantner is a buddy of mine. He's the sommelier there. And they have four Napa wine units there, Napa Technology wine units there that they keep the bottles in. They preserve the wine. So he serves very upscale wines by the glass. And, you know, and your regular pouring wines, he has all of that. But if you're a winer like I am, it's a great fun to go down there and check out some of these bigger wines. And he had a Burgundy on there, and it was funny because to me it just smelled like it was off a little bit. It had a little bit of a reductive smell. And I said to him, check it out. He goes, no, I trust you. I said, I'll just take a picture and get credit. And he opened up a new bottle, and it did. It was different. You know, the nose was different. But, you know, you're able to drink, or I was able to drink, a Burgundy that had a little bit of age on it. It was really, really good, you know. And he's got a bunch of He's got a bunch of like Bordeaux's on there and some bigger, you know, California cabs and stuff. So if you get a chance and you're into that thing, you know, go down and Rothman's and ask for Sean if he's there, the sommelier, and tell him I sent you. Tell him Tom sent you, and he'll hook you up. I mean, there's some really, really interesting fine wine that he has by the glass down there, which, you know, some of them are expensive, and you know, $30, $40 a glass, some of them. And that's obviously not for everybody. But if you're a wino and you want to taste something like that and not have to go for the whole bottle, which may be 150 or 170 or something like that. And he also serves them in half portions, too. So if you want to go and taste a couple to see what these wines are really like and without, you know, committing to the whole bottle, it's a great place to do it. I think that, you know, Tony Scotto does a lot of that, too. He's got some Napa technology machines in his restaurants and you know, in the steakhouses, and it's just a great way to educate yourself if you're thinking about trying to, you know, up your game as far as the wine education goes. You know, I always tell people, you know, take some money and go down to a reputable wine shop like a Stu Leonard's and say to the guy, listen, I have $100 or $200 or $1,000, whatever your number is. Give me a case of mixed wines. I'm just looking to learn different grapes and seeing and taste through. If you're a restaurant guy, you know, you can go to a place like Rothman's and you can, you know, bring, you know, whatever amount you're comfortable with and taste through some of their wines that they have there by the glass, which is a much less expensive way to do it. But it's a fun way nonetheless. I mean, you get a chance to taste some great wines and see what they're like and not spend as much money as you would normally, you know.
Tom, I just came to the epiphany that we need to either have social media pages or a website for Playing with Fire, because I just looked up a Durand,
mm-hmm.
and I know now how to use it.
Uh-huh.
Apparently, it's two pieces.
Yes.
And you screw in first, and then you put the blades in, and it connects.
Connects, and you take it out. Yep. It's fabulous. No, it's a great tool. I mean, I wish I had thought of it. You know, the only thing, I was talking to a guy who invented some kind of, I don't know if it's invented or developed, an algorithm or whatever that the entire world's markets run on. He's worth multiple billions of dollars. Very unassuming guy, very nice man, right? And I'm thinking, you know, I had the idea for disposable razors way before they came out, but I don't, you know, how do you build a razor? I don't know. And then they come out, and I went, wow, I thought of that, you know? And I'm saying to myself, the only thing that I really have is the chocolate bag. And it's made me hundreds of dollars over the years, too. I wouldn't be the 100 air I am right now if it wasn't for that chocolate bag.
That was a pretty good invention, I gotta tell you.
No, I didn't invent it. I just kind of adopted it, you know, so.
Did you actually make the chocolate vessel, let's call it, or you bought those?
No, I make them. I make them.
So how do you do that?
Oh, you got to wait for the book to come out, Stu. No, it's easy to do. You know, the coffee bags, the 1 pound coffee bags, the white ones that you get in, you know, in coffee shops or whatever, they're lined with plastic, you know. They're lined with like Saran or whatever, and, you know. So what you do is you open the bag, right? You cut it to whatever size you want. You paint the inside with chocolate, you know, melted chocolate. You refrigerate it until it hardens up.
Well, that was my question. So you essentially paint it.
Yeah, then I paint the second coat on it, you know, because first coat's too thin. Let that, you know, refrigerate, and then you rip the bag off the outside. So it takes the shape of the bag. But that's an old French technique. They used to do it with milk cartons years ago because milk cartons had wax inside, mm-hmm. you know. And the French used to take the milk cartons, paint them, and then they would have fruit coming out of them on a buffet or whatever. It would look like a sort of cornucopia of sorts, you know. So that's where the whole thought process came from. I remember the, you know, French guys that I worked for painting the inside of the milk cartons.
So you are incredible. So here we are. The middle of January.
Mm-hmm.
That means 4 weeks from now is Valentine's Day.
Oh, boy.
So for those that are well-organized and plan things out,
yeah,
what can you share with us a month out about Valentine's Day as far as food and wine? Because sometimes when Playing with Fire, we talk about food and wine.
Occasionally, yeah, yeah. Well, the one thing I'll tell you is I would advise you not to go out on Valentine's Day because everybody else does. I would go the day before, the day after, if you can slip that by the other half. And, you know, some people need to celebrate on the day. I don't think it's all that important. Yeah, well, Valentine's Day is chocolate and, you know, it's extravagance, right? It's chocolate and caviar and lobster and things like that. So I think if you're going to, you know, make a meal at home for your other half, you know, I would concentrate on those things because they're fairly easy to cook. If you're going out, I mean, I'm a, you know, I like oysters big time. You know, I like seafood. But I tend to shy away from some of that stuff now with holidays. I'm trying to create experiences, things you'll remember far beyond just the meal, you know, like, you know, I take these little trips, you know, these little educational / entertainment trips to, like, I'll go to Boston for 2 nights and I'll eat in 5 restaurants or 6 restaurants.
Does your accountant, like, tutor you on how to preface your vacations?
No, my accountant, all he does is yell at me. You know, he yells at me from, yeah, please, you know, my accountant. I love him, but he's kept me out of jail all these years. But he's like having a nagging mother, you know what I mean, at your disposal. But so I tend to advise, you know, here I am, the big love advisor, you know what I mean? But I tend to advise people to get out, you know, go away a little bit, you know, because, you know, people go to restaurants that they love and they're there all the time. Okay, we're going to go to Valentine's Day. Valentine's Day is the biggest day of the year, right? Pretty much. Mother's Day and Valentine's Day, the two big ones. Everybody's got to go out. Otherwise, you lose your membership in a boyfriend society or the husband's or whatever. So you got to go and take the girlfriend or the wife someplace. And,
well, Valentine's, you know, this year comes out on a Wednesday.
Well, that's
which
good.
I don't know, is a blessing
it's
or
a blessing.
Curse for a restaurant.
No, it's a blessing because you get 2 Saturday nights in the same week, you know, which is, you know, in the suburbs, it's critical, you know, unless you do 50% of your business in 2 days out here, you know. Anyway, you know, so rather than going to your favorite restaurant, which you do all the time, do something different. Go, you know, take a drive to Boston, stay overnight. You know, you have dinner and, you know, you have a bottle of champagne in a hotel and then go out, have dinner and, you know, come back. You don't have to drive anywhere, you know, sleep it off and, you know, go the next day and come home. Or Philadelphia is always fun. It's not that far. I think Philadelphia is like 2.5 hours or something from Nassau. I think Montauk, you know, go to Montauk is fun. You know, North Fork, you know, grab a hotel room.
So, you always get my mind wandering. So in the spirit of what you're saying, during COVID, there was all this talk about ghost kitchens.
Yeah.
And, like, you'd go to the gazebo in the middle of town, and they would deliver your food there or whatever.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And whatever. And believe me,
there's a
thread here. For New Year's, you were supposed to have a collaboration with one of your chefs.
Michael Meehan, yeah.
Which it didn't come to be. But I wish I was smart enough to know how you could have, like, a pop-up, a ghost-type restaurant and do, like, a special Valentine's Day thing or something. Because, again, I was so intrigued. The collaboration of the two of you and the selection of the menu was incredible. Yet, we're never going to get to, under normal circumstances, enjoy that scenario.
Yeah, well, the problem was that the venue couldn't get insurance for the day. And so we had to kind of, got to shutter the whole thing, you know.
Like, could you accomplish, I mean, how do you accomplish that? Like, do you take over a restaurant for the night or a catering hall? Like, how do you make something like that happen?
Yeah, well, that we were going to take over a restaurant that had closed, and they were interested in using it as a catering venue. So somehow the owner of that venue got a hold of my partner, Adam, and they were talking about doing a collaboration and maybe doing some, because we have a catering company also. We're going to do some events there. So we figured, all right, why don't we do a New Year's Eve party and we'll see if we all play nice in the sandbox together and, you know, see what happens. And so we decided to do this collaboration dinner. And Michael and I have been friends for, you know, 30, 40 years. And we used to do a lot of cooking together, a lot of fundraisers, a lot of things. We had we originally had an organization called LIFE, L-I-F-E, which was Long Island Food Experience, an acronym for Long Island Food Experience. And we were trying to, sort of give Long Island the same cachet that Florida had at the time with Floridian cuisine, because we felt like we had a cuisine here. We have vineyards here. We have farms here. We have fish here. We have, you know, we have it all here. And so we were kind of trying to, you know, like promote Long Island as a food destination for people, especially out east, because, you know, you have hotels and you have the Hamptons, you got the North Fork, you have all the vineyards, you know, there's a lot of tourist attraction out there. And, you know, we did get some national attention for a while, and then it just kind of, you know, it fell by the wayside, it kind of, you know, faded away or whatever. And so Long Island kind of got its own cachet going without our help. And so Michael, you know, Michael and I, although we're still great friends, you know, I don't see him as much as I used to. You know, you get busy with kids and grandkids and your restaurant and my restaurant, whatever. So, and we're not as young as we used to be. We used to, you know, we were two outlaws at the time. You know, we were out all the time, you know, whatever, partying and having fun and, you know, doing this food thing. And as you get older, you just kind of calm that down a little bit, thank God. And but, I, you know, we got together and we were promoting it on one of the radio stations out there. And I hadn't seen him in a while. It was just great to see him. He's a fabulously talented guy. And he's one of the main reasons that I decided to take this a little more seriously when I was a kid, because I was more of a screw up, you know, kind of. Yeah, I had some talent or whatever. But, you know, it was more about music and other things and whatever I was doing. It doesn't matter. But, you know, I decided to sit down and take this seriously because I ate at one of his restaurants, and it was called Mill River Inn at the time. It's a little jewel box of a restaurant in Oyster Bay. And I went, wow, I got to get my game up here, and because he was doing this fabulous food. So Michael was not only a friend, he was an inspiration. He's a great guy. So we were going to do this thing out at a place called the Grateful Rose in Port Jefferson, who, by the way, which, by the way, is owned by my first girlfriend ever in sixth grade. Take that, Stu. Yeah. Wow. And her and her husband hit the Powerball and decided to follow all their dreams. He always wanted to write a book. He always wanted to open a restaurant. I said, well, I know a little bit about both of those. You know, don't do it. You know, advised them not to. But he did anyway, and it didn't work out. And it's a shame, but, you know, you kind of see that coming. You have somebody who's never been in a restaurant business before. You know, going into it, you sit there and you go, oh, you know, be careful. This is dangerous waters you're jumping into here. And if you don't know what to expect, you know, you can get it in a lot of different ways. You can get it from the help. You can get it from the consultants. You can get it from the state, you know, get it from the lawyers. So anyway, it didn't work out. And they wanted to try and do this catering operation. So we decided we were going to have that dinner, and, you know, we got it all together and put the menus up, and Michael and I were real excited about collaborating again, and we were going to do most of the prep at the club, you know, because you have to do that. And they have a kitchen there, but I didn't want to go there and start, you know, ordering stuff and have it delivered there. It's just easier for me to do it at the club. And it turns out that they couldn't, for whatever reason, excuse me, get the insurance for the day, because you have to have, you know, for us as a caterer, I have to have a liquor license for the day, the off-premise liquor license. You got to apply for all this stuff. I have to have insurance as a caterer. You know, you got to have insurance in the place in case somebody slips and falls, which on New Year's Eve is a distinct possibility. And so that was the deal. And we had to kind of cut it down early and just not have it, which is a shame because I you know, we were getting kind of busy there, and it would have been a fun night. But, you know, it is what it is. What can I tell you? That's the story, Stu.
Well, I still dream of that coming to be, and to take it that much further in Nassau County rather than Suffolk County.
Yeah, well, you know, the whole thing comes down to a venue, and I don't know. You know, the whole thing has changed. I remember years ago, if you got a hit in Newsday, you would get busy, whether it was, you know, if Erica Marcus would mention something or Joan Remenick would mention something in her column. You know, you get this flurry of activity. It doesn't happen anymore. It's different now. Now you got to be on Instagram and, you know, and what do they call it, X or Twitter or what? I don't know, a twit from a twat from a twing or whatever, you know. It's just, you know, I have no idea what to do with any of that stuff. And no interest in it either, honestly. You know, I have some people who, you know, do the social media at Amano and Allure, but I have no idea what to do with that. And, you know, my capacity for new information, you know, I think your brain is like this little computer. And, you know, once you fill it up, you've got to get a new thing to stick in there, you know, to kind of gain. So I don't have the energy anymore to learn. You know, I have energy to learn music. I have energy to learn cooking. I just, the mechanical part of the social media, the computers and stuff like that, no interest in.
So I have to ask you, you were talking about inspiration in life as far as becoming a chef. When you were a kid or in your teens, was it the experience of eating or was the desire to create and prepare the food that got you?
Well, I was always that, I don't know if it was left brain or right brain, and one's the artist, one's the mechanic kind of thing. I always had the artist brain because of music and all of that. And once I got to, once I got in the kitchen, there was this sense of belonging and sense of like a familial thing that really appealed to me, you know? And I was just seduced. I was seduced by the sights, the sounds, the smells, the food, the, you know, I tasted a, you know, porterhouse for the first time. It was, whoa, you know, that's different. Filet mignon, whoa, that's different. You know, my mother didn't make that stuff. She couldn't afford it, you know? And
so you just said something that's really intriguing. You tasted porterhouse.
Mm-hmm.
What was it that made you? I mean, I believe, if I am correct, porterhouse is two different cuts of meat that are on the bone.
Yeah.
Was that it? The fact that you had a meal that had, you know, two different.
No, it was just the flavors in it. You know, the steak, I never had a steak like that before. I never had lobster tails before. You know, I never had filet mignon before. And all this, I was a steakhouse I was working in. And that and the fact that, you know, I felt valued there. You know, they were like, wow, you did a great job tonight. Or, you know, hey, you hung with it. You know, I'm washing dishes till 2 in the morning as a 15-year-old, you know. There was a sense of accomplishment. There was a sense of belonging. There was a whole thing. And then on top of that, you had the creative thing. I mean, I was learning how to, excuse me, when I got out of the dish station, I was learning how to, excuse me, I'm having something going on here. I was learning how to split lobster tails. I was learning how to clean filet mignons. And just working with a different medium other than a guitar and working with my hands was kind of appealing to me. And then, you know, I got hooked up with Shorty and he brought me on the line, you know, and I learned how to cook, you know, rare, medium, and well. I learned how to cook a lobster tail. I learned how to melt butter for it. I learned how to duck from a, you know, a vodka bottle being thrown at my head. You know, it was just nuts with him. But it was just, there was something about it. And then, you know, we all used to go out after work. There was this whole us against them, pirates life, you know. All my classmates in high school were going to pep rallies, and I was going to Pepe's until 2 in the morning. You know, I just felt like it just called me. It was like being a pirate. It was like being an outlaw. It was just different than all my peers, you know, and it appealed to me in a big way. And then as I got older, I decided to take it more seriously. Obviously, went to CIA and all of that. And you don't really, I mean, you get a decent education up there, and, you know, and you know, depending on what you put into it. But, you know, once you get out, then you got to either take it seriously or not. And I did after a while. It took me, you know, 7 or 8 years. You know, I was bouncing around. I was gaining experience, this, that, and the other thing, different, you know, restaurants. But then I decided to really take it seriously, and that's when I started eating out all the time and going to San Francisco and going to Los Angeles and finding out what these, you know, his restaurants were like and these chefs, what they were doing, Wolfgang Puck and Jeremiah Tower and all these guys that were getting national attention in the 80s. I wanted to know what they were doing. I wanted to find out what it tasted like and what it looked like and what it smelled like and what the restaurants were like. And I did. I went there and then opened Panama Hattie's, and the rest is kind of history. But, you know, I still feel like the student in the game. I mean, I just, you know, I'm constantly, whenever I go to restaurants, people, you know, that I go with, you're not paying attention, you know. Yeah, I'm not. I'm looking at everything but, you know, what I'm supposed to be looking at. And it's just, it's in my DNA. I can't get rid of it. It is what it is. And, you know, if you want to go to dinner with me, I'm going to ignore you for a few minutes here and there because I'm paying attention to what the waitress is doing or not doing, where the lighting is or where it isn't, you know, what the service is like, what the coffee cups look like, how they handle their cappuccino, what kind of design do they make on the top, you know, what the chef do, how do he use his garnishes. I mean, there's a million things. And, you know, restaurants are details. You know, it's like a restaurant is I call it like a ballet of chaos. You know, you have all this stuff swirling around at the same time. You got waitresses running in and out of the kitchen. The kitchen's, you know, going at warp speed, doing what they're doing. Bartenders shaking up cocktails. People are at the front desk trying to get seated. The hostess is trying to juggle which seat is up and who's getting a tip and who's putting it down. It's just this mess of stuff that somehow comes together, if you're lucky, at the end of the night. And I just think it's the most exciting thing that anybody could possibly do.
So you were you talked about a couple of things just as we end. You talked about Rothmans. You talked about steak. What's your thoughts on, like, enhancements to steak? I think, like, almost like a signature thing at Rothmans is, like, one of these unbelievable steaks topped with gorgonzola.
Yeah, I think it's fine. Whatever you want to put on your steak, put on it. You know, I'm kind of a purist. I don't usually use that stuff, any of it. Even béarnaise. I mean, you know, hollandaise to me is, like, a little bit scary because if it's not kept right and made fresh every so often, you know, you can get a lot of bacteria in it and make somebody ill. So, but I like steak for what it is. I like a lot of salt on it. Obviously, I think steak needs a lot of salt. You know, maybe a little dip once in a while in a steak sauce is fine. But
and the steak needs to be cooked with a little bit of fat, right?
Oh, yeah, I think so. Fat's flavor, you know. That's why filet mignons need sauces.
But too much is no good. Just a trim.
Yeah, well, you can always take it off, you know. But I think it needs to have. And when I say fat, I'm talking about the marbling in the meat, not on the side.
Talking about the side. Sometimes it's like thin.
Yeah. I take all that off. I don't use that. I just buy prime, and there's enough fat in the marbling to make it. So anyway. We got to go, Stu. We're going to sign off with Tom's Three Keys to Life like normal, if you could call either of us normal, which I don't think. But anyway, life is too short to drink bad wine. Treat every meal like it was your last. Keep chocolate in your life is as important as sex and pizza. And we will see you next week. Thank you.
Amano Osteria and Wine Bar has been created by Adam Lovett and Tom Shawdell to bring the feel and flavors of a true Tuscan Osteria to the North Fork. Amano showcases local growers, farmers, cheese, and winemakers, marrying their ingredients with the taste traditions of the Tuscan countryside. The casual appeal, the flavors of Italy, and a moderate price structure appeal to all, ensuring year-round patronage. This North Fork eatery sends out snappy salads and seafood, pastas and antipasta, along with a respectable wine list. Amano features local vineyards and Italian varietals from the U.S. and Italian wines. The kitchen remains open until 11 and has established a later dining crowd, sparking a local nightlife dining scene. Amano is on the cutting edge of a new high-quality and affordable dining experience on the North Fork. Amano Osteria and Wine Bar, 13550 Main Road in Matatuck. Serving dinner daily, Amano is also open for lunch on Saturday and Sunday. For reservations and further information, call them at 631-298-4800 or visit them on the web at amanorestaurant.com.